Good evening and welcome to another edition of Behind the Mask. I'm your host, Ed English. With us tonight, I have two incredibly talented guests who I actually was pointed their way. I have to give a shout out to my friend Renee Bernard for putting me in touch with these gentlemen. I know she's listening, so she'll love to hear that I mentioned her. But she pointed me in their direction, and I got to finding out about their project. My guests are Stuart Thompson and John Eastman. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Hello.
Now, the project that you guys are working on is called 13 Legends. And for anybody that's interested, the company that these gentlemen have created is called Frosty Ogre. So if you want to head over to frostyogre.com, that's FrostyOgre.com. You can also find these guys on Facebook, or you can do a search for 13 Legends, and you can find all kinds of links to different places that people are talking about this unique project. For those who are listening, if you want to call into the show, if you've got a question for these gentlemen, the call-in number is 646-200-4071, and we have the chat open online if you want to ask a question there. So, guys, let me just jump right in on 13 Legends. I've always been a fan of alternate reality stories. Back in my heyday of collecting comics, I know DC came out with a whole series that they called Elseworlds. And this kind of reminded me of that whole thing because it's things that we know, but just a different twist or a different timing. Tell us about the world that this is set in. What is this alternate reality?
Stuart?
Okay, so we started to think about the world changing in the year 1492. Which obviously is a hugely significant year on lots and lots of levels, and all sorts of things were kind of interesting then. But I think we moved forward from that point and imagined what would happen if one of Leonardo da Vinci's fantastic designs for weaponry went missing. If one of his incredible pieces of warfare mechanics fell into the wrong hands and someone built a machine that was capable of bringing war into the industrial age. And, of course, that would change history in lots and lots of levels. So we imagined, you know, what's going to happen if the world gets mechanical really early and the whole globe changes because of that. And we kind of imagined all these different little changes that happened across the world that meant by the time we get to the point of our story really kicking off, which is towards the end of the 18th century, that we're living in a world that is mechanically or technologically very advanced, but in other ways is really kind of still quite archaic. So that's kind of the altered reality that we came up with, you know, that we've ended up at a period where it's very, very dissimilar to what we know because technology caught up super fast. And the world changed. So that's the basic kind of backdrop to the story.
Now, you say, you know, you talk about the advancements, and that's kind of self-explanatory. But then you say, in a way, still archaic. How so?
Well, if you imagine that, you know, like warfare has become advanced, but perhaps the way that people can communicate hasn't made the leaps that we would expect it to make. So, you know, you're talking about a world where weaponry is incredibly sophisticated, but maybe people are still relying on really old-fashioned ways of communicating. So you've got, you've got these World War I type kind of situations in terms of the advanced technology, but maybe people are, you know, like messengers are still carrying messages. So, you know, there's a disconnect with what with how people can fight, with how they can communicate at a core level. So that would be one way that it is dissimilar. In one way, the society is really advanced, but in another way, the society is really feudal in terms of how people relate to the hierarchies. So there's ways, you know, that it really deviates from how we would expect that period of time to be.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. There have been some other stories that are like that. I guess if the focus has been on war machines, then mm-hmm. you know, the focus wouldn't be on the telegraph or the telephone or
yeah,
or things
exactly,
of that nature.
Exactly.
Because if one country has, you know, steam power or munitions, then all the other countries are going to be clamoring to focus on that area as well. So that does make sense. But
something else that John and I played around with when we were thinking about the world was this idea that war can be pretty good for business. And we've sort of been playing around with the notion that maybe some of these wars aren't perhaps what they seem, and maybe it actually behooves the people behind the wars, to ensure that communication isn't particularly good, if that makes sense. I hope I'm not giving too much away, but that's one of the ideas that we've been playing around with, that, okay, maybe this permanent warfare is actually quite a good thing, and maybe technology has advanced in certain areas and not advanced in certain other areas by design.
Ah.
So that's something that we've been kind of talking back and forth about.
So it is, and I don't think you've given anything away, but for lack of a better word, the warmongers are specifically prohibiting advancements that might undermine their agenda.
Possibly.
Okay.
That's one angle of it for sure, and it's also the development of these, like Stuart says, the technological advancements are playing into the fact that, you know, you have, I mean, the mixture of archaic mindset, or not archaic, but, you know, old school mindset of line up your troops and start shooting each other, but you have planes, and you have bombs, and you have these more advanced, you know, weapons. It sort of is like a hyper version of World War One, where the old notions of warfare are still being used, and that may not be, I guess, what Stuart's hinting at, is that may not be an accident. That may be by design.
Okay. So now you mentioned the 18th century. So I assume we're talking about perhaps the Revolutionary War, or as my college history professor made a very significant point, the War for Independence.
Right.
Was not a revolution.
Right.
Took place. But then we bring in this whole other aspect that makes this story completely unique and one of a kind and awesome, in that we're looking at the characters from Arthurian legend. Tell us
right.
about that.
Well, that's, you know, Stuart and I had wanted to work on some kind of Arthurian project pretty much since we met. I mean, maybe a year after we met, we were already talking about a potential retelling of, you know, the legends in a more modern sense, like a post-apocalyptic story. And that just, it didn't really resonate with us, and it didn't go anywhere. But basically, the genesis of that was that I had been working on another project that much of the main core sweeping epic story of 13 Legends is sort of based on. And pretty much, I hadn't seen Battlestar Galactica, is what it comes down to. And the minute I started watching Battlestar Galactica, I realized I could not go forward with the project because it was too similar. But when I instilled some Arthurian stuff in there, just, you know, to test and see what happened, it really worked. So that was pretty much how it started. And I showed it to Stuart, and he really liked it, and we started developing it.
So tell us, you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, obviously the names that people recognize, Arthur, Lancelot, Guinevere, Merlin, etc. How do they fit into this story? Where does the story start with them?
It sort of reintroduces them in our own core story. So it's introducing them as characters like you've never seen them. So Arthur and Lancelot are redcoat soldiers. and they're being sent to the New World to fight the armies of the Venetian Republic, which is pretty much the biggest maritime power in our 1770s, our version of the 1770s. And so they're not, you know, Arthur's not a king. He's not of royal lineage. And so we're not being, you know, some people will probably lambast us for messing with the canon, you know, or whatnot. But we really, you know, want to just have fun with it. So so you'll probably be surprised at the roles of a lot of the characters. But where we are really true to the stories is as it gets deeper into the series, you'll see that the dynamics, it's not random. We didn't just, you know, make females male or, you know, someone who's old, young, or do the sort of cheap, you know, easy fix. We do have a rhyme to our reason.
Something that I think, you know, just listening to John talk about it, and also having just talked about the background, is, I mean, when you look at the Arthur stories, they sort of were, in their own way, revolutionary fighters, you know, because they kind of had to reinvent the world because the kingdom was in decline, and then, you know, Arthur was this kind of outsider who wrestled the sword from the stone and had to really create a whole new order, you know, because it was a world that was falling to bits, and he comes into it and there's a whole new sense of justice and energy. And I think that's partly why, you know, it seems so appropriate to set against the backdrop of that kind of revolutionary conflict.
No, totally. It fits. When we really started getting more deeply into the, you know, the Uber story, that beyond what I had, you know, done in you know, broad strokes early on, it does mesh very well. The revolutionary period, you know, isn't the revolutionary period in our stories because everything's changed, like we talked about. But we're doing a more of a global revolution in this book.
Yeah.
So it is the revolutionary period, but on a much larger scale.
Well, that makes sense. Now let's take a step back a little bit and talk about, you know, the origin of this story, where it came from, and how you two guys have brought it from idea to almost a finished work here. John, let me start with you, since, you know, this was your original brainchild. Tell us about your background with comics and whatnot, you know, where you came from and what brought you to this idea.
Sure. So my comics knowledge might be a little better than Stuart's in that I did read quite a few comics as a kid, and I've read many graphic novels as an adult, but it pales in comparison to most of the people I know, to be honest. So I don't really have that depth of I should say superhero comics is what I'm talking about. I know a fair amount more about other genres in comics, but I did grow up with Green Lantern and Wolverine, X-Men, G.I. Joe, even, you know, all kinds of different comics as a kid. So that's my background for you know, where my interest started with that. But Stuart and I met in film school in San Francisco, and we were both studying to be screenwriters. And so our backgrounds are in writing screenplays. So I had written a number of screenplays, as had Stuart, and we were developing ideas collaboratively, him and I, and also separately. And one of the, you know, things I was trying to do was to come up with a TV idea rather than a feature film idea. And as I already told you a little bit about, I started down this road of a more of a sci-fi kind of story, and it just was similar to something else. And I repurposed the main thread, which I thought was still really strong and different, and combined it with the, you know, something we'd wanted to work on, the Arthurian legends, and then decided to make it alternate history as well. And so those three things sort of come together to make 13 Legends. I think that's where the unique aspect of it really is that it's all three of those things, not two out of three, or, you know, you find a lot of things that cover two different, you know, you take something and you make it different one way. But I think it's a little risky, I admit, but I think we've made it different two ways. One more would probably break the camel's back, but, you know.
Well, Stuart, we talked a little bit before the show that you're not a native American. Tell us about your background and you know, what brought you to the States and into screenwriting and into collaboration with John.
So I'm from Glasgow in Scotland, and I worked in theatre. For about 15 years over there, and then I started to get bits and pieces of work in television and in film, and I realized I didn't really know what I was doing. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do? I thought I'd go to America. So I came to film school in San Francisco, and John and I met in our second semester. And bizarrely enough, I'm actually sitting in the room that John and I met in. I've just realized, because I now teach at the university that we went to, and I'm sitting in the same room, which is quite odd. John and I, as John said, we wrote quite a lot of different things together, and I have a really, really limited knowledge of comics. And the comic tradition in Britain is kind of different than the comic tradition in the States anyway. We tend to have, there's like the comics like the Beano and the Dandy, which are like mostly episodic and will have like multiple stories in them that maybe only take up two pages and kind of move like sequentially or don't move sequentially or kind of standalone stories. So my knowledge of comics was probably limited to that. And then I started to read the occasional graphic novel. But not a huge amount, although there were things that I really, really liked. I really, really liked Love and Rockets, the Hernandez brothers. I really liked them when I was an undergraduate. So I have a little bit of knowledge. But when John and I spoke about this idea, and I think at first we talked about it being television, and I think John said that. But then when we started to think about it in graphic novel terms, it made a lot more sense because I think the scope of it is so huge. And it really does have there's an epic quality to it that I think really lends itself to the graphic novel.
And I think it's that global aspect that you've spoke to before.
Yeah. I mean, it's colossal. It's thematically colossal. It also takes place over a huge scale, over a huge amount of time, and there's a big, you know, the whole thing has a very epic feel to it. So as we were getting further into the research for the comic, before we even started to write, I kind of decided that I needed to educate myself in terms of graphic novels. So I read quite a bit, and I think I became much more impressed with the possibilities of the graphic novel. And I think it's a really useful form for screenwriters to look at, because obviously it tells stories in a completely different way. But when you really craft a good graphic novel, or you read a really good graphic novel, I think it hooks you in the same way as a movie can. I think it can become a very visceral, a very emotional experience. And that's something I didn't expect at the beginning of this process, that I would come to see graphic novels as having as much power as they do. I think that it is an incredibly powerful form, and it's been great working within the dimensions of that.
I find it interesting. You know, I've actually met a couple other comic writers who actually come, you know, from the screenwriting arena, and it's interesting how well that field lends itself to telling a story in graphic format.
Absolutely.
Some of the comparisons of a storyboard for a television show versus a comic page are incredibly similar. You mentioned that you're in the room. I just have to tell our listeners, Stuart actually kicked his class out so that he could come on the show for a half hour.
Yeah.
So I definitely appreciate that, and give them our thanks as well. For their patience.
They'll get a free copy of the book.
you've got an immediate following right there.
Absolutely.
So let's, you know, when you put the story together, then and you're starting to form this and you're starting to script it. Now we're talking about, you know, I've seen some of the character concept artwork. You guys have an incredible video that features a lot of the art from the story. And the artists that you have in Gianfernando and David Ocampo, I mean, that's phenomenal. How did that happen?
Well, pretty much what happened is we waited until we had a decent amount of the script. I actually wrote the prologue that you see. I wrote a rough draft. I learned how to do comic writing with that prologue. So I didn't actually tell Stuart anything until I had had a admittedly not a very good version of that that I brought and showed him. And that's really, that was my first experience writing a comic. And after we tweaked that and kept adding to it and got, I'd say probably mostly through the script, we started talking about concept art. And so we hired concept artists, looking through their portfolios and had a lot of submissions. In fact, we had hundreds of people submit. It was a little bit overboard. We didn't realize when we put out ads what would happen. But it was pretty overwhelming. But through that process, we really were able to hone in on the tone and the mood of the world. And we kind of knew what we wanted. And so when we went looking for the penciler, it was actually pretty easy. Finding Gian was probably the most simple part of the process for the the independent contractors that we've had working on the series. His sample that he did, we commissioned a sample from him, and it just blew us away. So we just hired him on the spot, pretty much.
Wow. As always, our time is fleeting. I don't want to leave without talking about not only this video, which is available on your website, but you talk about kickstarting the adventure. So I definitely want to talk about this Kickstarter campaign that you guys have got going on. I'd never heard of Kickstarter till I'd seen this. So give us a little explanation of what you guys are doing here.
Stuart?
Well, Kickstarter is really, really interesting. It allows you to fundraise for an arts project online, and basically you set up your stall and you say, here's a project, here's the different amounts that you can pledge, and here are the rewards that you get for pledging. So you kind of tier your rewards so that the more people contribute, the more they will get back. And the great thing about it is it allows you to have a kind of a neutral platform for raising funds for your project. And we worked quite hard, and especially John, in terms of crafting something that would be really appealing. And so it went up just over 2 weeks ago. And our original budget, we were looking for $10,000 to really get this thing going. And we've been kind of smashing through that, which is really, really great. I think at the moment we're at around 138% now. So we're funded, but we need to keep going, because obviously the more that we raise, the more that we can channel into the art and the more that we can push the project forward. So it's been a really, really great response. People have really loved the material, and people have been incredibly generous in terms of the donation. So it has been really, really overwhelming, the support that we've had. But obviously, we need continued support, because we still have over 2 weeks of our campaign left. And the more people contribute, the more we can fund the great art that we've been getting from our artists. So we really need to keep those pledges coming.
Well, now, I mean, as if it wasn't enough that you guys are giving away, basically, 25 pages of your comic, of your graphic novel, up front, which, you know, from what I haven't had a chance to read it all yet, but just looking at it, I'm so impressed at not only the story, but the graphic quality as well. You know, people can go to your website, click the link, they can get a downloadable PDF with like the first 25 pages, and that's incredible enough. But if they contribute to the project, the things that you're offering on your fundraiser, you know, you're doing a special edition of the book for specifically for those who contribute, which is incredible. And then, of course, depending upon the level of contribution, you've got, you know, increasingly larger contributions or packages of artwork and inclusion. You know, I looked at the big package and wished that I could magically come up with $2,000 so that I could contribute at that level to be not only in that book but have my own story. But what gave you the idea of the special edition for those who are contributors?
Well, there's some practicality to it, and we just want it to be a really nicely done book. It's going to be super high quality, hardback. But the truth of the matter is we didn't want to publish the book ourselves. You know, we wanted to test the water with some of the bigger publishers who we've got an eye on to pick up the series. So we knew that if we self-published it during this process, we would really kind of hamstring ourselves. Many of the bigger publishers just don't want things that have already been published by someone else or self-published or what have you. So what we decided to do was a limited edition of the book that was only for people who pledged on Kickstarter, and we absolutely won't be selling this after the Kickstarter is over. So it's just pretty much a prize for being a part of the Kickstarter campaign. And if this gets picked up by, you know, Dark Horse or Vertigo or whoever, you know, they're going to print the first volume, much, much larger volume of them, amount of them, I should say. So this will actually be pretty rare if this series takes off. However many people buy it at Kickstarter, that's the only amount that there will ever be. So, so yeah.
And that's incredible. Just real quick, you know, we've got just under 3 minutes left. Tell us how you came up with the title.
Oh, basically, 13. The number 13 was in the title of the project that I actually shelved, and I actually came up with the genesis for everything really came to me on the 4th of July. I was reading an article online about the American Revolution, the Founding Fathers, and I saw the picture of the flag with the Revolutionary flag with the circle of stars.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, 13 stars, 13 colonies, like the Arthurian legends. I'm like, 13 legends. I'm like, okay, we got to pick 13 of these Arthurian legends and instill them in this story. And that was pretty much where the whole idea started.
Okay, well, that's interesting because I was thinking originally, my first thought was, you know, with the stars that you guys show on the video, that it would be 13 colonies. But then in reading that this isn't, you know, the United States of America, you know, trying to break free from Britain. So where does that play in? And then I thought, you know, I'm trying to think back how many knights of the Round Table were there? You know, were there 12
right.
knights and Arthur and you know, where was this coming from? So I was definitely interested in where you guys, how you guys came to that.
You've honed in on a little secret there. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
So I'll need to keep that in mind when I read my copy of the book.
Absolutely.
You know, deeper in the series, you'll definitely that will come into play. Yeah.
And speaking of deeper in the series, we're just talking about volume one here, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And how far out have you guys written so far?
The Bible of the story is in very, very rough, broad strokes. All of the big arc things are there. But we have only written the first, you know, obviously the first one's written, and we are actually right now writing the second one. So it's more like a TV Bible. So you don't write all the shows simultaneously.
Okay.
You leave yourself a little wiggle room.
Right.
But the bigger plot is there.
Okay. Well, we have, amazingly, 30 minutes always flies by, and there's always more questions to be asked. But we are out of time. Stuart, John, I want to thank you for joining me. I definitely don't want to get it. All of our listeners, go to frostyogre.com and check this out. Check out their Kickstarter campaign. John Stewart, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Join us again next week on Behind the Mask.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.